Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisor of the Year.
All right, folks, we're on the Property Couch, where each week Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property investing. And, mate, welcome to the couch. I think I'll give you a fair wide berth here because I'm not feeling great.
Yeah, no, I'll probably, sounds like I'm going to do most of the talking today, mate, but that's all good. You know, yes. I'd like to talk underwater when it comes to property.
I was going to say, mate, I'm happy for you to do the heavy lifting today, but we're going to start with an apology.
Yes.
And it appears that our judgment last week, Ben, was poor. And we've got some feedback from some of our loyal community of listeners to suggest that what was meant to be a light-hearted attempt
at
what we thought was humour was poorly executed, poorly received, and would appear to have been a gross failure.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, when just one complaint from anyone around stereotyping is enough for me to say, you know, we've missed the mark on that one, so we decided to pull the episode down. There's other ways in which we can deliver that content. So for those who missed it, that's okay. We will cover that content again in another format. But, you know, there's absolutely, you know, it was silly for us to think that going through this sort of men versus women stuff was going to be any good.
Well, it was silly for us to think we're comedians because clearly we're not.
We're not.
But I own the mistake. It was my idea. I pitched it.
Oh, no. We're a team.
No, hear me out here. I pitched it. The backstory was quite simple. I spoke to Veronica, who's my co-host on the show, Location, Location, Location Australia. She had a blog that said four reasons why women make for great property investors. I got on the phone to her. I said, this is really great. We're in the content business, Ben. We're always looking for angles. So I rang her and I said, can I use that blog as content for a video that I'm going to do here? And I'll acknowledge you. And she said, yep, no problem. So Ivis and I then shot a video for the Empower Wealth newsletter. We always send out videos, Ben, twice a month. And so we had a lighthearted tongue-in-cheek, and it was me saying, I wonder if Veronica's got it right, and it was fun, and we had a good time. Yeah. So then I've come armed with those four bullet points, thinking straight away, I'm thinking, here's a way we can have, in my mind, the execution was, let's have a win for the ladies. And then what I didn't factor in is you and I were going to get competitive. and then you and I probably went down a chauvinistic path in that competitive nature. And so for me, I own the mistake. I know you and I did it together, but it was my idea. I pitched it. We aren't, my team is largely made up of professional women.
Yes.
So I don't subscribe to the fact that men or women, because I actually vote with my feet. My team's full of women. So I was personally quite distressed during the week that we'd offended our audience. So I humbly apologise. I own the mistake, and it was my decision to pull the episode down because for those of you who heard it, didn't appreciate it, and for those of you who are listening to this who didn't hear it, chances are you haven't missed anything.
No, we'll get into better context and generalisation, stereotyping. You've heard us talk about on the podcast before. We don't like to be generalists. We like to be specialists. And so by having that conversation, it was meant to be a bit of banter and a bit of fun, but when we're trying to pad out 40 minutes or 35 minutes or whatever, it just became, you know, a bit of a
competitive
slog. Yeah, but, you know, wasn't fun at all. No. So we didn't get our message across as well as we should have, so we move on.
And equally, blokes wrote into us and told us that we'd missed the mark as well.
Yeah, so. And fair enough too. I think they're absolutely right. So we've jumped on it. We've written back to every one of those people who've given us that kind feedback, and we'll pick up our game and we won't do it again.
We won't do it again. We'll hopefully show better judgment and give people hopefully value for their time investment in listening to us.
Yes.
Today, mate, this week, rate cuts.
Yes.
You predicted it. You sent your video out during the week.
Yeah, we did. Look, it was not hard to predict, to be honest with you. But I'm also looking at what other commentators are also saying and looking at the numbers. The reality is that the Australian cash rate is high on a global sense. Inflation is probably the larger concern. The RBA has a charter and they need to work to that charter, and part of that charter is full employment. Okay, so even though our unemployment rate is not, you know, extremely high, we're sort of sitting around that sort of 6% and, you know, sort of dropping and sort of sitting just above it. So as part of their charter is to try and get full employment. And we have spare capacity in our employment market. So even though we're not seeing 8 or 9% unemployment rates, what we are seeing is underemployment, which means that people who want to work aren't working the full hours. So as part of their charter, their job is to try and stimulate that through their monetary policy activities. And that's what they've done. And as a consequence of that, they're also trying to make us competitive on a global marketplace where, you know, there's a lot of zero interest rates and in some cases negative interest rates in some economies. So will this make a huge difference? It's probably not going to make as big a difference as, you know, the mindset shift that happens when you move from flat or an upward cycle and then come back to a downward cycle. So sentiment's not going to be any stronger, but it is going to give some confidence. So even if it picks up one or two more jobs here and there, or says to a family, maybe it is time we did look to buy a home or do those types of things, that's a positive thing. Expanding that out a little bit more, we saw CBA immediately release their announcement on what they're going to do. So they did a 0.13 of the 25 basis points cut. And for me, I think that was sort of a bit of a price forwarding, as I call it, or price announcement, which then saw the other banks, the big four, sort of follow suit. So what they did do is, because effectively that looks after their lending customers, but what was interesting, they also, you know, sort of did, I suppose, a market message by also raising deposit rates. What that means is basically if you put money in a term deposit or interest that you earn on the money that you give the bank to look after, they actually raise those. So they didn't drop that. Whereas traditionally, as the cost of money gets lower through the cash rate, you would normally see that deposit holders don't earn as much interest on the money they've lent, you know, they've put in the bank. So that was a good move to look after both sides of their balance sheet. So both sides of their customer base. So there's a lot of, you know, older people who are in a position where, you know, those term deposits are what they live off in terms of the income that they receive from those. So that was a nice message for that side of their client base. Yeah. So, you know, the other little trend that we're also seeing is this separation between owner-occupier and investor lending, and obviously the separation in some rates there. And we're now starting to see a little bit more pricing around principal and interest loans versus interest only. Now, if you've studied us, or if you're new to the podcast, we advocate for interest-only lending with offset structures and money smarts. If you want to learn more about that, it's not hard to look through the podcast episodes and find our money smarts and anything we talk about lending. And there's a real big reason for that. Fundamentally, we want our clients to be in control of their own liquidity as opposed to being in a position where they may not have cash reserves or buffers as well. So, mate, here I am dominating the show again, but I know you're sitting there going...
welcome relief at the moment, because I'm sure you said something coherent then, but no, I heard every word you said.
All right, so that's a bit of a wrap-up on interest rates. Will this be it for the end of the year? More than likely, but there is still a very strong probability that we'll probably see another interest rate cut in the new year, maybe February, March, if there's still further evidence, you know, that the RBA have got their charter, and if there's still spare capacity and inflation still under control, that's their job, you know. So, you know,
it's funny. We had the REBA conference this week, Ben. Real Estate Buyers Agency Association, Sunday and Monday. We had Dr. Andrew Wilson from the Fairfax Group,
Domain. Yep.
And he said a couple of interesting things. He said that bandwidth of 2-3% is a figure that's from days gone by, which doesn't necessarily mean that it fits into the economy moving forward. So he says it's an arbitrary figure that they work towards, but probably based on history rather than present.
Yep.
And he also talked about things that we've already know through other presentations and other people that we talk to, that he believes that the ongoing capital growth rate across the country is 3-4%, which is, for a lot of people, they're probably going to be more conservative in their views. But again, across the country means that there's hundreds and hundreds of sub-markets, which we've always said. So that doesn't mean every market's going to do that, but it means a couple of things. Asset selection is going to be more critical than ever. But all of the books from the last 10 to 15 to 20 years that assume 10% is the norm, is not going to be the case.
No, that's true.
Now, when we build the plans, we've got some comfort around the areas that we're buying doing better than that.
Yes.
But there's just a... I guess the summary of that is that it's not just about putting your name on a title. We've said that now for the last 75 weeks. But in history, it was. It was just putting your name on a title and just waiting for time to do the work.
Yep.
Moving forward, the asset selection is critical. And his talk was largely around, you know, that the time that we're in is unique and something that we can't necessarily lean on history to know how we're going to move forward.
There's some really good points in that, Bryce, and I'd like to spend a minute in talking through a couple of those. So, again, if you're new to the podcast, I recommend you go back and listen through because there is some sort of journey that we take you on. But I'm going to pull out a couple of points, and I'll quickly see if I can summarise this. In the 70s, we had single income, mum getting a second job. Okay, so that started to see more discretionary income. In the 80s and 90s, we saw more work from both parties, and then the children coming through, male and female, looking for careers. And so now in the 90s, 2000s and beyond, we've got double household incomes. So throughout that course of time, we've seen the rising tide of income push the annual rate of return on properties at around 7 to 8%. So no wonder people think bricks and mortar is a wonderful investment. But the reality is that during some of those periods of time, we also saw interest rates at 18, 17, 18, 19%, extreme interest rate. In some periods of that time, check this out, we also had inflation running between 9 and 12%. Mm. You know, that is extraordinary. And so wage growth then needed to keep up because the cost of goods were going to get. So then we had the recession that we had to have. We bottomed out, we restructured our economy, we became more competitive and we got more efficient and more productive. We restructured our labor, our labor wages and so forth, and you know, took a few heavy unions out of the process as part of that. Don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-union at all, but there is a balance. You know, we're trying to find that middle. So sometimes unions have the power, sometimes the owners have the power. And so anywhere in the middle, it's a constant flux that we're in.
Yeah.
So what Andrew Wilson is referring to is this concept now that we're seeing very little wage growth. And when you've got really low inflation, you do get an asset appreciation, you know, because people's money and money's cheap. So that automatically puts an extra bit of demand in the market. And that's what we're seeing in the bigger cities where the economy's still going fairly well, that we're seeing this, as you always refer to, rising tide lifting all ships. But the reality is if we stay in this low interest rate environment for a long period of time, then it'll bottom out. You know, it'll get to an affordability level where people are saying, you know what, this is what our money delivers us and this is what we can afford. And so we're definitely getting an artificial increase in values in some of those outer suburbs, which I think are unsustainable. I've said that before. So, you know, my two biggest boogie markets, is that the word? dodgy markets is the Greenfield Estates and also the medium rise, and high rise. So they are the dodgy markets that I'm still trying to think of what that word is, but I've got no help here because
bogey.
I must get some more sleep at night. I'm doing too much research at night at the moment. So there are our challenges, and I agree. So if you then think about that, if you think if wage growth en masse, and this is this generalisation, and we've learned about generalisation in the past, if you generalise and you've got to say a median price of a market is X, and that's how you can deliver your, you know, sound bites to media, and that's what they report in the news, that's all irrelevant.
Mm.
So you're absolutely, you nailed it early on when you said asset selection is going to be critical. And just because the broader income in a marketplace or a city is growing at a soft rate, and this is probably the biggest critical point, is inside that community, there are people who are getting 10%, 12%, 15% income growth in what they're doing, whether it be in their own business or as they progress through their careers. And as the economy grows and there's more companies and more people are earning six-figure salaries, it's about following the trend of that income to the areas and the scarcity of those areas. So it's a supply-demand story, but it's also that human behavior, you know, human interest story in terms of where people want to spend their money because property is an emotional asset.
Yeah, you only have to think about suburbs like Albert Park and Middle Park here. They've got extraordinarily high medians that continue to grow year on year.
Yep.
Think about some of the lower North Shore or Bronte. Think about Bulimba. Think about Cottesloe and Perth. They are above average performers that consistently perform above average for the very reason you just said. The people who are in control of their own income are zeroing in on those suburbs. So that's the science.
That is the science. And I think, you know, a quick little shout out for the census. We've got census on August 9. The government's extended a little bit there because there's a bit of concern around privacy at the moment. But that census is really handy data for all of us researchers and property investors, because we are trying to pick, you know, we talk about blue chip country as areas that has real scarcity, has very high net worth people who want to socialize with other high net worth people. And then the areas next to that are the gentrifying areas, the ones that are becoming these types of locations in cities where they might have been workers' areas, but they're close to major employment, they're close to the infrastructure, they're close to all those things. And that's, you know, coming back to the game of property and the practicality tests and all those things that we're talking about. And, you know, we'll be launching that. It's imminent, isn't it, Ivis? Our practicality video is absolutely imminent. But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, stick around. We'll give you some details.
So we've got Q&A.
We've got some Q&A. We've got lots of really great questions. So Matt has sent one into us. Hey, fellas, LV Podcast. My only disappointment with it is I didn't find it early enough. I'm also now halfway through your book and find that it's equally enjoyable. Thanks for the feedback. I have a unique question that may be limited to a select demographic. However, appreciate any response you may be able to offer. I am 26. I'm a welfare officer in the Royal Australian Navy and currently own a 5-bedroom house in Griffin, Queensland, sold to me and my de facto partner as a house and land package, and has just recently completed construction. In brackets, yes, I understand. There is a better way now, ! Close bracket. I have a unique housing situation, as all defence members are offered subsidised housing. That means it's more financially beneficial to live in these places rather than purchase a primary place of residence. My partner earns approximately 55K and I am on 100K. I see myself in the Navy for around 10 more years because of the strain that being in the Defence Force and specifically the Navy can have on your relationship. After this, I plan to join the Fire Brigade, which will offer a lower salary. Excuse me for that. Hopefully you have an understanding of my background to answer my question, which is, how do you plan for a reduction in income when you are still reasonable distance from retirement? That's number one.
Yes.
Number two, would it be wiser to maintain current income for the long-term potential, or is there a process that could be applied? I appreciate the complexity of the question. Feel free to adjust if necessary.
Maddie, thank you so much for the question. It's an interesting one because on two parts. So whether it's you're in the Royal Australian Navy or whatever, if you've got a job that allows you to have some accommodation that's paid for by your employee, then effectively you've got an advantage because your disposable income can then be put to work. You know, and we talk about this sometimes as being rent vesting. This is an adaptation of rent vesting. So you're only halfway through the book too. By now you may have finished the book and you would have seen how we do go about it. And this is how we go about it. We talk about cash flow and we do look at long-term projections. So Bryce mentioned earlier about how we do our planning. Well, we look at every individual household and we measure cash flow for the next 40 years. So if we do have, and we have plenty of miners who are out in the mines and they only want to do the job for another 5 or 6 years, and then we work out roughly the income that they'll be earning once they move back to a city location, because it will be less. So in your case, it's going to be the same thing. So whilst you've got a strong income and whilst you've got really strong surplus, the argument for us is we would probably be focusing on buying a strong capital growth asset because your incomes will be able to service the shortfall earlier. But then when the incomes get lower, then we potentially start looking for what we call a balanced asset, which has a mixture of growth and yield. And then to finish off the portfolio, we might put a cash cow, one or two cash cows into that portfolio. So what is important about that is is to model out your cash flows and to understand the cash flows you've got now and see those changes. And unfortunately, Matt, that isn't easy. I mean, that's why we've built our own internal software tool.
It's taken 5 years to get to this point.
Yeah, it has because you know, irrespective of your situation, even in mine and Jane's situation, when we had the, you know, the three properties that we'd already bought, the question was, how many more of these things are we going to need? And how do I work these calculations out? And how do I know that with multiple splits of loans and having money in offset accounts and looking at tax deductibility and looking at all the moving parts? So that's why we went away and built a software program that can do that for when we advise our clients. That said, we've had some of our listeners who have sent in some of their models to me, and I've seen some really nice, clean, simplistic spreadsheets that still cover off on the majority of the variables you need to consider. And in previous podcasts, I have talked about all the assumptions. I've talked about occupancy rates. I've talked about maintenance costs. I've talked about long-term interest rate forecasting. I've talked about wage growth. I've talked about indexation. So all of those things are in previous episodes, and they're also in the book. So you'll see all the assumptions that are in the book as well in terms of how we model the case studies that we do at the end of the book and how we achieve $100,000 passive income for life for those people in the book.
And the hardest part, Ben, for anyone who's doing their models is the time value of money, trying to get context about if you're going 40 years, what does that actually mean today, so it has some real relevance.
Yeah.
And being able to do that calculation, the present value calculation,
Totally.
Is probably the one that undoes any model over 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
To make it meaningful.
Yeah, so when people come to us and they say, look, I hate my job, I earn really big income, but I can sustain this for 5 years, then we really pressure test them on that. Because if they're going to invest in a significant asset and take on significant debt, and then in 18 months' time they're like, I can't stand this job anymore, I want to get out of what I'm doing, that could be a problem, because the reality is it costs you a lot of money to get in, and if they can't sustain that, then we might be putting that property up for sale, which means we're probably going to see a negative number and some losses around what we were trying to do. So I always say to people, and in your case, Matt, you were talking about, is it wiser to maintain long-term current income for the long-term potential? My view is live your life, and then whatever we've got left over, and this is for those people who may not also be on high incomes, if we've got a surplus, we can help you, or you can help yourself in terms of investing in property. But you've got to be astute in terms of making sure you understand your cash flows. You've got to factor in all those future provisions, such as changes to income, children, school fees, all those additional costs that we experience in life. And, you know, just look at the current NAB ad that's going around. I think that's a good ad that sort of explains that. I wouldn't say it's $450,000 per child that they've said in there. You know, if you think about your own children and what you're spending on them, but that just gives you an idea. And, you know, their message, I think, is quite good in that ad, and that's, it's not about the money, it's about the journey. And if you're going to, you know, flog yourself in a job you're not enjoying because you think that this is going to be the panacea to get you retired earlier and so forth, I say I wouldn't approach life like that. Life's too short. Smell the roses on the way. Get a job that you really enjoy. Follow your passions. And then we can still make a wealthier outcome, because Steve Jobs wasn't happy when he, you know, kicked the bucket. He had a fair bit of wealth, you know, so.
And lived incredibly humbly.
Yeah, exactly.
So a couple of things. Always try to look to increase your cup size, Matt. So by that, if you earn $100 a week and you save $10, you're saving 10%. If you earn $200, you save $20. You're still only saving 10%. So find out, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago in the Money Smarts. Try and find out where your level is for living, and then whatever the surplus is, irrespective of any pay rises, trap that surplus and put it into property. I remember just recently listened to Jane Slack-Smith was interviewing Jan Summers.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, she's the number one.
Yep.
For me. I've never met her and I want to. She is incredibly humbly living.
Mm.
Incredibly. And
yeah.
To the point where she, you know, goes camping and spends, you know, money on the tents and everything rather than the 5 stars on the side of the building, you know, living under the star. So interestingly,
she's finding her passion. So she loves the outdoors. She loves walking.
But her MO is to not be frivolous. It's to find her own level and stay at it, not sort of lift the level just because she's got the resource.
Yeah.
And that's what I took away. That's if people can find their own level, whatever it is.
Yep, whatever it is.
And then when your resource increases, don't increase your level just because your resource has increased.
Yeah. Well, I think some people naturally are aspiring to that. That's what motivates them.
Mm.
For other people like her, it was just the fact that she's got peace of mind. She's got financial independence and she's got peace of mind.
Mm.
I did listen to the same episode on Jane's podcast, and you know, she still flies business class to Europe.
Yeah, that was
which
one.
Is good.
Yeah,
so yeah, so yeah. And so for me, because again, I have seen people. I mean, there's the famous story of the guy here in Melbourne who rumoured to have upwards of 300 units, and he drives around in a clapped out old Mercedes Benz.
Right.
He's got all of the keys to all of these units in his car, and he's you know, he's obviously worth tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And he...
That's forgotten.
Yeah, he won't... He's got, you know, shoes that have got holes in the bottom. So the whole, you know, his psychology has transformed him into something like it's a game, but he's lost all purpose, all sense of reality in what he's trying to do. So there is a danger in that. So I've seen people who have been...
I think it's called financial anorexia. I'll check that. But we had an episode of the show where we had someone who couldn't... He'd saved and invested over $1 million... and couldn't part with it.
Yep.
So it's interesting because that does happen.
It does, you know, and it controls you. We're always about you controlling money and putting in the mechanics and the frameworks and the systems and the processes about you being in control of money. Because at the end of the day, it's just tin and plastic, all right? So it's just, you know, it's a material and it's not worth the number that's on the piece of plastic that you're looking at. So don't let it control you. Don't let it, you know, don't be a slave to it. So by putting all these processes and then having balance in your life, you know, don't go to the extremities. Some people want it for power. Some people want it for attention. Other people just simply want to provide for their children. And that's about getting context around why you're doing this.
It's a currency to trade for time and experiences. That's what it all comes down to.
Very good question. That's a good one. Currency to trade for time.
Tim Ferriss might ask me for a reference here, but he says that the new rich are people who get their time back and their experiences back. So people want to be a millionaire because they want the time and the experiences that they think they've got.
So bring that back to Jan. Her experiences walking Milford Sound tracks, doing all the things, getting back into nature. She's got the time to do it.
She's got her time, she's got her experiences, and she's happy.
Correct.
So there we
go. Right.
Very good question, Matt. Hopefully that was helpful.
Thanks, Matty.
Another one from Adam. Hi, gents. Big fan of the podcast and the book. I've really appreciated the education, experience, views on property you're making available to people. Before I came across your podcast, it was very difficult to access any sensible opinions or information on property other than the extreme optimism of commission-chasing spruikers or pessimism of the bitter doomsdays. That's a pretty good summary. I was hoping in your next Q&A, perhaps Bryce might be able to address the topic of bidding tactics at auction. Most of the tips and strategies you read amongst the property press propaganda are ridiculous things like dress up in a suit and pull up in a sports car out the front. In your experience, one of the guys in our show did that. He pulled up in his, he borrowed his, the Range Rover, and he got the old, that was
the
funny.
Polo shirt or something.
He was doing it in tongue in cheek, which was funny, but anyway.
Yeah.
Now I should have put my finger where I was. In your experience, is there any value in these sorts of image approaches or concepts like knockout bids or bidding late or auctions, or are auctions predetermined events going to whomever was always going to pay the most? I know you will say the gold standard is to employ a buyer's agent, but I'd be interested in your tips for someone to do it DIY. My answer to that is very simple. The most consistent tactic that I've seen, because I've seen individual tactics work, I've done hundreds of auctions.
Yep.
The most consistent one I've seen work is confidence. So when you are confident, it intimidates other people more than having a Porsche, having your Tom Cruise aviators, having a group of people to stand next to you, dressed in a pin suit. And if you look at any of the episodes that I've done on the show, and we've got some on the property couch, some tactics, I'm always trying to keep the spotlight back onto the person who I'm up against. So if I'm up against you, Ben, you do a bid and I'm in the game, as soon as the words come out of your mouth, I'm generally straight back it with a confident, loud bid. So the focus is never on me, it's always on you. Now, I know that you like public speaking, but generally speaking, most people don't like that environment.
No.
So I want the spotlight on them.
Yep.
I want to see how they react under pressure.
Yep.
I want to read their body language.
Yes.
I want to see what they do when they talk to the person they're standing. I'm 100% strategy to put all of the spotlight on them because the auctioneer is working on them. The auctioneer is saying, come on, it's only a cup of coffee, or next week you're going to be back looking. He's using every technique in the book, and I want to see how they are under the pressure. So confidence is the number one thing. Knockout bids actually do work, and I use them, particularly when I know from the agent that there is a number of people who are keen on the property. So when there is, I will do sometimes a $100,000 bid over the guide price. I've done my comps, and I know I'm not overpaying, just to set a very strong message that I'm there to buy. And then if I overlay with the confidence that I was talking about when I bid from there, what I want them to think is, because at the end of the day, any tactic that you employ is ultimately relying on you having more money than the other person.
Mm.
So if the other person has got similar money to you, it doesn't matter if you roll up in a Ferrari, they're still going to be there standing. So I want to plant a seed of doubt in their mind that says, I'm just going to give up because this bloke's going to buy it anyway.
Mm.
So they don't throw away their last 10, 15, 20,000. That's effectively what I'm trying to do. And then if I'm not up against another professional, I'm up against another, particularly first home buyer, and this sounds harsh, but I'm employed by a client to act in their best interest. I prey on the fact that they are very, very new to the process. They're very vulnerable and they've probably priced it somewhere around the price guide. So I go in very aggressive, very confidently, and very strong. All the same tactics. So they're the consistent ones. And then there's a few, you know, ones that I pull out at certain times, depending on the auction.
So out of 100 auctions, how many, what percentage do you think that you definitely know that you sort of can influence? I mean, I've got a rough figure in my head in terms of, you know, the number that you can make a difference in versus the not, but what are your,
I think I can professionally intimidate a very high percentage of outcomes from other bidders who aren't professional buyers.
Yeah.
So 9 out of 10.
9 out of 10.
Mm.
So for me, you know, if people have got their set price and they've done their comps well, it is just a matter of street theatre.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there is that element, that, as you're saying, confidence. And I remember doing one in Hampton, you know, a few years back. And, you know, I had a little strategy that I used, which was to go in late and to go consistently, like what you're saying, with showing lots of confidence. And so it became a 1-to-1. Now, at the end, I did win for the client that I was working for. And the other party, you know, I acknowledged him with a you know, hello. And they just came up and said, it was clear that you definitely wanted this and you're going to pay any price. Well, the reality was I wasn't going to pay any price. In fact, I was very close to, you know, running out of steam, you know, running out of the money that I was given. So in that particular case, I think that the body language and the confidence that I delivered versus what I could see in them, we were very close. So I think we did influence that one. But there are definitely going to be some auctions that we go to, even as professionals, and we can do all of our, you know, you can look confident, you can do all of the communication, you can talk as if you know the agents like friends, you can do all those types of things, but someone is going to have a deeper pocket. And that one...
I don't win 9 out of 10. I can just reckon I can influence 9 out of 10.
So, yeah. So it's a good point. So I think for me, it's probably 30 to 40% we can potentially influence through our skill and through the negotiation. And that takes time and practice. So if you're looking to get better at it, go to auctions. I mean, how many? 1,000? You?
Hundreds. Yeah.
Hundreds. I remember spending 5 years in Sydney going to every evening auction session, watching how, because, you know, in those evening sessions with Ray White and so forth, you could have 8 or 9.
Yeah.
So you could see what was happening in the room. You could see the different tactics people were using. So, yeah, you know, and if there's an auction in my suburb, I'll pull up.
Mm.
In fact, in some cases, I actually even start them. My wife gets upset with me because I sort of know roughly there's no way I know that's going to be worth this. So I just get it started. And Jane goes, what are you doing? I said, look, if we get it for this price, trust me, I will buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the sort of
there process. There you go, folks. There's a future podcast coming up where we're going to tell you Ben's accidentally bought a property.
Yeah, I didn't do my comps on it that, you know, the backyard had a sinkhole in it or something like that.
It's funny. I bid for my cousin. And they coming in late is the other point at times.
Yeah.
I knew that. I know the theatre. The agent does all their stuff, and they've got their theatrics. But I know they're going in at half, for a halftime chat.
Yeah.
And if they're not, I know when they tell me when they're not.
Yeah.
So the auctioneer was looking at my cousins, and I'm across the road standing on my own. And all of a sudden he's gone, going once, going twice, and then he's looked straight at them and gone, "Guys, are you in?" And she's panicked. And she's gone, "I don't know. Bryce, are we in?" She's like, and I've gone, "Oh no, I know." But so the point is, sometimes you come in late.
Yep.
Sometimes you come in early. So there's no rule, but there's a couple of things I tell you that you should do each and every time.
Please.
If you can, go and talk to the auctioneer in the middle of the auction, just before the auction, so that everyone can see you talking to them.
Yep.
Even if it's just good luck, saw you had a great result the other day, hope you have a great auction, just so that, because people don't know what you're talking about,
yeah.
So that and so that the auction is effusive.
Yep.
And then when you bid, so that person's name's John, you go, "I'll give you $1,000, thanks, John."
Yeah.
Because again, I want to plant a seed in the other bidder's mind going, does this bloke know them?
Hmm.
And what's going on here? Yeah. And therefore, when people are unsure, they put their hands in their pocket and they sort of go, "Oh,
this is insider trading. This is not fair." When they get angry, they get off their game, and you're moving forward.
Something doesn't seem right here. So, another very good tip. So, there are two things: confidence, talk to the auctioneer, and my third one is do not be a pest.
No.
Some people think the old, "Excuse me, Mr. Auctioneer, did you realise that the back lean-to has got asbestos riddled through it?" is actually going to score points. And the auctioneer is used to that. They plan for that. They normally go, "Yes, sir, you've had 4 weeks of the campaign to sort that out. I'm sure everyone here has made their judgments based on that. I encourage, but we had 5 building inspectors." So it makes you look stupid.
Yep.
And it actually, I want the auctioneer to throw the hammer down to me. I know what human nature is like.
Yep.
I want him to throw the hammer down to me, to not, because I've seen it too many times when a pest has annoyed the auctioneer. And all he wants internally is to go, "I don't care if anyone buys it except for you." He doesn't say it, but his body language says everything.
Totally. In fact, you know, now that we're getting into this sort of stuff, I can tell you that 10 years ago, it worked a treat. You know, but knowledge is growing. Oh. People's understanding, same thing about asking the auctioneer, "Are we on the market?" You know, some people are also asking that. When I go up and talk to the auctioneer before, that I actually say, "So how do you, you know, have you got clear instructions, or are you going to seek further instructions?" So I know when so I don't have to worry about, "Oh, wait, mate, is he really going to knock this thing down?" when he's given me clear instructions in terms of how he's going to approach this auction. So, yep, I'm going in there and I'm having a nice conversation with him, introducing myself, who I am, and sort of saying, how do you normally, have you got clear instructions? Yep, you'll call it when it's on the market. I haven't seen you work here before. So I'm sort of learning about, if I know how they work, you know, so if I've got Milo and my local area, I know how those auctioneers are going to work. But if I don't know the auctioneer for the first time, I'll go and introduce myself and say, what's your process? Have you got clear instructions from your vendor, or are you going to seek further instructions if you're not quite over the line? And they'll say, "Look, here," and I always say, "Finally, make sure you come to me at the very last stages and to get my final response."
Mm-hmm.
So I make it very clear to them that I've given that. And their duty of care is to do that, because ultimately I will report them if they knock it down without coming back to me.
So great dialogue to have in front of everyone, Ben, because the other people can't hear what you're saying, and they think they see a meaningful exchange, and then you call the auctioneer by name. So there you go, folks. There's no rules other than, for me, confidence, talk to the agent, call them by name, and then the rest of the tactics, I've got to say, are auction specific.
Yep.
And I haven't seen someone pull up with a Porsche actually consistently intimidate a bunch of people.
I reckon there's another episode on this. I think we've got a few more things that we can share, and we can even bring in maybe a professional auctioneer to talk from their side of the fence as well. Which would be really, really cool.
Yeah, very good. Hey, as always, when we do Q&A, folks, disclaimer, I know it sounds boring, but don't act on the advice that we've given. Use it as a general guide to go and ask better questions of your advisor so that you can get specific information for you. Hey, Ben.
Time's flying.
Yeah. We just had some books arrive this week with the bestseller stamp on it. Yeah.
We've had to reorder because it's become a bestseller, Bryce, which is really humbling.
It is.
You know, coming back to Mac's question before, and some of the feedback I've had is people who have gone and bought the book whilst they're listening to the podcast are getting more context. So they're reading it and they're getting it reinforced with a podcast. So if you haven't bought the book, here's my blatant plug. I think, you know, it's a great resource that you can write notes in, you can highlight points, and you can solidify what we've been talking about in regards to that. So we still remain number one on Amazon under buying houses in the real estate section. So you can download it, or you can come to our website, which is thepropertycouch.com.au/book, and it's available there. So I do recommend, because...
There's a code, Ben, TPC.
Is there? Well, so there, now what's that do? Does that give a discount?
It's a discount.
Whoa, discount for listeners.
Yeah, exactly.
Discount for listeners, you beauty. That's good, I didn't know that. And it's in some cases...
Katie said it six times for the last 75 episodes.
I concentrate on this.
I know, you're doing a great job, mate.
So do that, because what we have found that it's in most bookseller stores, they're restocking it, but only restocking one or two.
Mm.
And then they go and it takes another 6 weeks for them to restock it.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is, if you want it, come to the website, grab it there, and we'll have it out to you that day.
Yep.
You know, it'll be in the post that night.
And interestingly, Ben, the Facebook Live that we did on the couch, the feedback we got was great.
Fantastic.
So we're actually going to dissect some key frameworks in the book.
Cool.
Unpack them, as you would always say.
I do.
Facebook Live in early September. So for all of our listeners, if you, and we do have a lot of you who have liked our Facebook page. So for those of you who haven't, please like the Facebook page, because we will send you the notice.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do a Facebook Live. We did it at 8:30 last time, Ben. So we're interested in the feedback on that, because we're trying to think of the Perth people, makes it 6:30.
Yep.
So we want to try and find out if that's a sweet spot, or if 8 o'clock or 7:45 is the sweet spot, so that we can keep in mind the Perth folk, but also make sure that the people on the East Coast aren't falling asleep.
What will make that, sorry mate to interrupt, what would make that even more powerful as a learning experience is if you've got the book in front of you whilst you're watching, and you can refer to the page and you can see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, that's good, because we haven't unpacked the 18, you know, principles, the research principles. There's lots of things that we still haven't sort of gone into, but that's going to be the start of that. So if you've got your book and you can ready to go for Facebook Live, you're good to go, you'll be able to see the pages.
And we'll make one promise, Ben.
What's that?
That we won't start the video on a 90 degree angle.
Most people who were live got to experience us sideways.
They could lie on the couch and watch
it. It was
us.
Edited out in the follow-up recording, but yeah. Well done to Ibis. She's a superstar.
Ibis does, she doesn't some like amazing negative things. Feedback. No,
no,
no, she doesn't.
She's a perfectionist.
Yeah. What does a perfectionist mean?
A perfectionist?
Yeah. Is there anything like a perfectionist?
A perfectionist?
Very good. So, yep. So we're going to do Facebook Live, and we're going to unpack some key frameworks in our... Where's my mind going? Key frameworks in the book for the benefit of the listeners. And also the Money magazine that's hit the stands, Ben, as we speak.
Yep.
We wrote the cover story for it.
Fantastic.
We're the first story on property, and I don't want to give too much away, but there's $2.5 million worth of bonus for reading that article.
$2.5 million worth of bonuses?
Yeah, well...
Get out there and buy that Money magazine.
Hang on, I better put a disclaimer in. Subject to terms and conditions. But no, the outcome was the $2.5 million bonanza from implementing the strategy. So there you go. And tomorrow, Ivis tells me that we've talked about the practicality test. We've talked about the game of property investing. Well, we're not going to talk about it anymore. We're going to release it.
It's out there. When's it happening?
Well, tomorrow.
Tomorrow! Woohoo!
Tomorrow. We are going to release it on Facebook first.
Friday, what time, Ivis?
Oh, if only you could see the look, folks. If only you could see the look.
Friday, before we go on our office.
Oh, yeah, Tenpin Bowling.
Yeah, we're going Tenpin Bowling, team building, Tenpin Bowling.
So
tomorrow, tomorrow PM.
There you go.
Tomorrow,
if that's not an incentive. If that's not an incentive to go onto Facebook to get that, because I've got to tell you, folks, this was a labour of love for Ben,
mm-hmm.
and it's some great content, I've got to say. And I know he's a Collingwood supporter, I don't like to give compliments.
Go Collingwood against the West Coast as well.
But it was good. It was good. So, folks, go to Facebook, like us. I'll have to put that out. And then we were planning to have Veronica on this week, Ben.
Yes.
But we thought it was important just to... make that apology first thing on this episode.
Yep.
But we do have Veronica next week. It's a great episode.
Yeah.
And that's for those folks who want to listen to it, no problem.
Yep.
Those folks who want to watch it, no problem.
Perfect.
We can do both.
We're on the couch.
We can do both. So there we go. And Now we throw it over to you, mate.
Lead it as you do. Okay, Bulgarian.
Ooh. Have we done Bulgarian?
Is there no tick next to Bulgarian?
All right.
We've got Burmese. I've done Burmese, but Bulgarian.
There we go.
Why do you think we've done Bulgarian? Anyway, I'm going to do "See you soon" in Bulgarian,
okay,
which is "Dor sukuru."
Dor sukuru.
It sounds a bit Japanese, didn't it? So yes, this one is Bulgarian, and it is "Dor sukuru."
Well, it's perfect for Facebook, for the Game of Property Investing, because it's "see you soon." So we will see you soon tomorrow on Facebook, the Game of Property Investing.
Do you know what "till tomorrow" is?
Oh.
Du or tre. Du or tre.
There you go, folks.
Till tomorrow.
Until tomorrow, du or tre.
Du or tre.
Okay, see you guys.